Second.
Ms. Christensen?
May it please the court, counsel. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Joanna Christensen, and I represent Frank Calabrese in this matter. I'm going to discuss the double jeopardy issue. I'll try not to overlap much, but I do have some specific issues regarding Mr. Calabrese. I would have called this case more of a Danish, but that's my ethnic background speaking. The first prosecution, which was in 1995, and I call in my brief the 1995 prosecution, was completely subsumed by the 2005 prosecution of Mr. Calabrese. Nearly every piece of evidence that came in, and it's a little different because Mr. Calabrese pled guilty rather than went to trial the first time, every piece of evidence that came in was something related to both trials. The government essentially had a trial on the 1995 conspiracy within the 2005 conspiracy. As I discussed in my brief, this court found originally that they were two separate enterprises. It became very clear at trial from the evidence presented, the government's witnesses, that it is one enterprise, the outfit. The crews cannot exist without the outfit. Nobody in a crew could make a move without the outfit, and it's not just murders that were sanctioned by the bosses. Bosses could tell people where to go. There was an example of someone who was running an adult bookstore with coin-operated peep shows. And bosses of the outfit came and said, you need to talk to him because he needs to pay street tax, essentially. And it was not a crew decision every time. These were outfit decisions, not crew decisions. Management of the individuals in the crew might have been a crew decision, but if one of those people got out of line and it affected the outfit bosses were in charge. Everybody knew that when you were dealing with a street crew, you were dealing with the outfit. Simple street crews probably would not.
But corporations have multiple contracts, all of which are, you know, subject to firm rules and supervision and so forth. And does that mean that really there's only one contract?
I believe that in this case it is only one contract, the furtherance of the outfit. That's why they do every step that they do. And when the workers are working, the soldiers are working on the street collecting street tax, they know, and everybody else knows, they're collecting street tax for the outfit, not for themselves personally.
If you're making a contract for a corporation, I say a corporation that builds aircraft for the government, well, then they have every time they sell a new plane, they have a new contract. But it's all on behalf of the corporation. It's all supervised, controlled by management.
I would argue
these are separate agreements. We don't think of them as not separate because they're all subject to management control.
I would argue that the autonomy in a business situation is more than the autonomy in this situation. This was run in some ways as a business, but in other ways as a very controlled entity by the bosses. And not with the autonomy that a business would have, subsidiaries would have from their parent company. Usually the ability to make...
Subsidiaries, that's separate. I'm talking about simply separate contracts by the same corporation.
And certainly in a corporation, the corporation itself would give the ability to its employees to make certain decisions.
It might or might not. There's more and less delegation within organizations.
And I would argue the less delegation, the more likely it's one entire entity, and the more delegation, it's more than one. In this case, the delegation was limited. I certainly think the same pattern of racketeering in this case and the 1995 case is there. You have everything subsumed within the 2005 case from the 1995 case.
So of what significance, though, is it that there's just a lot more proof of, shall we say, outfit-level decisions that come in this case than did in the earlier two cases?
I think it's a function of what the government had at the time that they knew they could prove.
And so essentially because Nick Calabrese decided to.
Without Nick Calabrese testifying, you have almost none of the murders. You have very few of the details about the planning of murders, and that's the base what they had. They might have had some idea, and I think there's no doubt, but we can only conjecture, that they had some idea that these murders had taken place and who was responsible for them, but they couldn't prove it. And the case law says the government can't have a bigger bite at the apple after they've had a bite of the apple.
You're talking about Thornton?
Yes, that they can't bring a narrow charge with the hope of someday flipping someone. And who knows if they hope that, but they, I assume, would hope someday they could prove who committed these murders and hold someone responsible.
But the only way to do that was through a conspiracy charge, if it was going to be done at the federal level, I assume.
True. I think I would have to guess, but I would think these murders could have been brought at this point federally through a simple murder charge. It would have to be a conspiracy, a RICO conspiracy, mm-hmm. as it is in this case. In some ways, that makes it much easier for the government because they don't actually have to prove the murders to prove the RICO conspiracy. They could have proved everything else and not the murders, or just the murders, or nothing, and they still have a conviction on the RICO conspiracy. Then, of course, it all comes in at sentencing. That's the ease of the RICO statute. The RICO statute was designed to cover wide-arching conspiracies, which is the other reason this case mentioned more of the outfit bosses than the other one did. This case was a 40-year conspiracy. To get that in, because people die, people leave the conspiracy, they had to talk about the structure more. With the limited 1995 conspiracy, there was less of that because it was a more limited time period. But that's really the only difference, the time period, which is completely subsumed into the 2005 conspiracy.
But reading the earlier indictments, they certainly seem to focus on the street crew level of activity. They focus on the juice loans. They focus on the street taxes. They focus on things that each of the two indictments, the particular street crews were doing, whereas you don't get that feeling looking at this indictment. This is it's a much more ambitious undertaking, more years, more activities, national scope.
Certainly this is a broader indictment, although the first indictment did cover extortion and street crews, collection of street taxes, and gambling, sports bookmaking, which was all in the 2005 indictment as well. The addition is the murders. The murders, of course, because they were outfit murders, were all related to the outfit activity.
Suppose the Alabama chapter of the Ku Klux Klan was prosecuted for a conspiracy to, you know, murder black people or something. And suppose the head of the Alabama chapter is also an official in the National Ku Klux Klan. So would that prosecution bar a conspiracy charge against the National Ku Klux Klan?
I don't think it would bar against the National Ku Klux Klan. It may bar against some of the members of the Alabama.
I don't understand. Suppose this person, there are famous examples from World War II. I don't have conspiracy writ large, but, you know, Reinhard Heydrich, who is the who ran Czechoslovakia after it was taken over by the Nazis. He was also the principal deputy to Heinrich Himmler. So he had two jobs. One was sort of local job running Czechoslovakia. The other was his role in the national security apparatus of the Third Reich. So if he were, of course, he was assassinated, so he didn't get to be tried. But if he had been prosecuted for conspiracy to all the bad things done in Czechoslovakia, would that mean that a later charge of conspiracy against the SS couldn't include him because he'd already been prosecuted for something else that was closely related, because it's all part of one overarching enterprise?
I think the key in your example is that you said he had two jobs, and that indicates a separation in the agreement of what he was doing. You're testing my history, Your Honor, and I don't know enough about how the hierarchy worked.
Well, it seems that in the outfit, you can be in a street crew, but you can also be promoted. It is, as you say, it's a little more loosely organized than a government or a corporation, mm-hmm. but still it has these distinct levels of agreement, doesn't it?
I think you would never hold two distinct jobs in the outfit. If you were the capo of a crew, you were the capo of a crew, and you reported straight up the line. There wasn't as much parallel to the jobs. And earlier, I believe when you were speaking to one of the other attorneys, you talked about moving from crew to crew. That was actually discouraged and rarely happened, according to the FBI.
Both Marcello, both part of the street crew and also a higher...
He could move up.
Yeah, right.
But from crew to crew, it
would
be unlikely.
But not at the same time. Did he hold those positions at the same time or seriatim?
No, it would have been a promotion, essentially, as anyone could have in a business, a promotion up the ranks. But you didn't move from, say, the Calabrese street crew to Marcello's crew back and forth. It didn't happen, according to the FBI.
But if he was promoted, I mean, why isn't that a good example of how you have different conspiracies? You're a low-level person involved in a low-level conspiracy, then you're promoted, now you're in a big conspiracy.
Because the agreement remains the same. The agreement...
You say the agreement remains the same. There's obviously a difference between these entities. The street crew is not identical to the outfit.
It's not identical, certainly, but it's part of...
Opponent.
It's part of the outfit, and
of course, that's the whole point. It's a component.
Exactly. You can't have one without the other. So then that's an enterprise, the same enterprise. If one could function without the other, that would be a different example. If the street crews could have functioned at the level at which we all know that they did from this case, without the outfit, that would be a much different case. But you couldn't be a member of a street crew.
A different case? Why?
Because then it would be a street crew conspiracy.
I don't know what this has to do with criminal law or the Constitution at this stage.
Well, the Double Jeopardy Clause certainly has to do with the Constitution, and that's what the violation is here, is the Double Jeopardy Clause.
But you're saying Double Jeopardy depends on how this citywide mob structures its organization?
In RICO cases, it's about the enterprise and the agreement. And two components, the same enterprise from our point of view and the same agreement. When you have the same enterprise and doing the same agreement, generally in furtherance of the mob, the outfit, then you have the same RICO conspiracy in both cases. Before my time runs out, I'd like to address shortly the threat that Mr. LaPuma talked about. We, of course, have different takes on this, which is probably obvious from our brief. I start from the point that the credibility determination made by the district court judge is completely erroneous. The juror was so inconsistent in his testimony regarding what actually happened that it's far too incredible that it happened in the courtroom the way he said it did.
But can you think of any examples in which a court of appeals, I won't even just say this court, has overturned that kind of credibility determination? Judge Zagel, after listening to the juror, thought that the juror was honestly reporting what he thought he saw.
Your Honor, in my years of doing this, I have never challenged a credibility finding like this.
Well, probably for good reason. You're an excellent
reason.
Lawyer. And
But in this case, there's a reason I did it in this case. There's never been the evidence that's so conflicting about what was said, how it was said, the demeanor in the courtroom. This is a different case, and I think you'll hear that over and over again, is that this case was different. The media attention, the onlookers, the agents that would have been in the courtroom to see this, the distance between the juror and Mr. Calabrese, it simply doesn't make sense. For him to testify that Mr. Calabrese either said, you're dead, or you're a fucking dead man, those are very different lip-reading, visms, as it's called, I learned, in my research. And it's not possible that he saw both of those at the same time come out of Mr. Calabrese's mouth. Mr. Calabrese was at times disruptive, at times made statements. I'm not denying that. This statement, however, becomes something about retaliation against the prosecution, which is a much more serious statement than anything else that he had previously said. And as I'll rely on my brief for the remainder of that argument, I want to make it very clear that the district court judge credibility determination in that case, this is one of the very, very few cases where it should be overturned. I'll save the rest for my rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Christensen. Ms. Winslow?
Good morning. We've been talking over the last three arguments sort of around the issue of what was the enterprise that was charged in this case. Of course, it's Mr. Shiro's position that the enterprise that was really charged in this case was an illegal gambling enterprise, which Mr. Shiro had no involvement in. In fact, the only evidence that the government offered as to Mr. Shiro's involvement in this case was a 1986 murder of Emil Vachti. That was June 6th of 1986. And the government would have the court and would have had the jury believe that based on this 1986 murder, Mr. Shiro was part of this overarching conspiracy called the Chicago Outfit. It's troubling, the argument that's presented in support of this being one overarching conspiracy, because as you would have it, this would be a RICO case dating back to Al Capone, in essence. If the enterprise here is the furtherance of organized crime in Chicago, it's just simply too broad of an enterprise, and it is not the RICO conspiracy that was charged in this case.
In fact, why is it too broad of an enterprise? I mean, you know, it's a big company, I'll give you that, but they're putting to one side whether this is the same or different from what went on before. It seems to me conceptually the Chicago Outfit is, you know, a major organized crime entity in our country, just as there are families in New York and there are organized crime groups elsewhere.
Without accepting that the Outfit of Chicago is something that actually exists in this particular instance, we would be talking about furtherance of organized crime without any specified criminal activity. The criminal activity that this case really focused upon was an illegal gambling enterprise from the 1990s. The way that the government was able to charge this ancient conduct was to include the ancient conduct in furtherance of this illegal gambling enterprise. That's too broad. In fact, you can't establish that an individual like Paul Shiro, who was last taking the evidence in the light most favorable to the government, as we must for this argument, was last involved in any potential activity in 1986. It just simply doesn't follow that the 1986 conduct the government charged would have anything to do with furthering the illegal gambling enterprise of the 1990s. With respect to the 1986 conduct, it was, of course, the murder that was charged from June 6, 1986. The jury did not find Mr. Shiro had committed that murder.
That's DeVacci?
That's correct. The jury did not reach a finding beyond a reasonable doubt as to that predicate act. So the question that remains, what further activity is it that the government charged and proved at trial that could establish that Mr. Shiro was part of the conspiracy as charged or part of the enterprise as charged? In fact, it didn't offer any further evidence. Following the 1986 incident, Mr. Shiro believed that his life was in danger, that Frank Schweiss, who was originally charged in this case, was going to kill him, and he went into hiding. There's no further testimony, there was no additional testimony about any further acts by Mr. Shiro which would have connected him to the charged conspiracy in this case. So it's Mr. Shiro's position that the weight of the evidence is in favor of a finding of insufficiency of the evidence. In fact, he was not connected to the offenses charged.
But if he was a member of the conspiracy and he never withdrew from the conspiracy, then he's accountable for reasonably foreseeable things that other conspirators did.
My answer to that is twofold. But in essence, he would be, except, again, it's our position that the conspiracy that he participated in is not the conspiracy, not the same enterprise as is charged in count one of this case, in the RICO enterprise of this case.
So what was his conspiracy? Is it a time limitation in your view, or is it a geography?
It's neither. It would be the furtherance and the interest in the furtherance of the conspiracy. In fact, the illegal gambling enterprise that's charged in this case is something entirely unrelated to, separate from, and different than the conduct of the Chicago Outfit in the 1980s. It didn't exist at the time. The government hasn't argued otherwise. And in fact, in its response to our brief, the government offered no other evidence that Mr. Shiro was in any way involved in the furtherance of the outfit's activities as charged in this case. They simply argued that there were other individuals who believed, but didn't know, that Mr. Shiro was a member of the Chicago Outfit. For instance, Mr. Romano and Ms. Spilatro said that they believed based on their observations of other individuals' interactions with Mr. Shiro, that he had some position within the Chicago outfit. That, I submit, is not proof beyond a reasonable doubt, and it's insufficient to sustain the verdict in this case, particularly in light of the jury's failure to find or the jury's decision not to find that he was responsible for the 1986 murder. That suggests very strongly that the jury rejected or did not credit the testimony of Nick Calabrese. He was the only individual who offered any direct testimony that Mr. Shiro was involved in the outfit, and the jury did not choose to believe him. Based on that, it's clear that there was insufficient evidence to find that Mr. Shiro participated.
Now, wait, did you say the jury did not believe Nick Calabrese, when he said that Shiro was a member of the outfit? Well, when you based that on him?
Nick Calabrese's testimony with respect to Mr. Shiro was limited to the 1986 murder. That was the sole universe of their interaction. The jury did not find, beyond a reasonable doubt, that Mr. Shiro was responsible for the 1986 murder.
But he could have been a member of the outfit, yet not responsible for the murder, right?
But there's no other evidence to suggest that he was a member of the outfit.
What did Calabrese say, exactly?
Well, Mr. Calabrese, describing the murder, indicated that he met with Mr. Shiro in Arizona and that he was introduced to him as somebody who would participate because he was familiar with Mr. Vacci, and that they committed the murder. He dubbed him the Indian, a name that's never in any other proceeding ever been applied to Mr. Shiro. No one's quite sure where that name came from. One suggested that it came from Mr. Calabrese because the incident in question took place on Indian Head Road or something along those lines. But there was no other evidence that Mr. Shiro was a member of the Chicago outfit. All there was is speculation based on his interaction with other...
Couldn't Calabrese be right that he was a member of the outfit and that he was supposed to commit this murder? There was discussion of his committing the murder, and yet wrong that he did commit the murder? Why would that be inconsistent testimony?
Mr. Calabrese actually committed the murder. There's not a lot of speculation as to that. He admitted that he actually committed the murder. It was the question of whether or not Mr. Shiro was involved in the conspiracy. So beyond Nick Calabrese's testimony, there just simply isn't anything more that would connect Mr. Shiro to the Chicago outfit. In addition, and more specifically, there's nothing, and the government doesn't argue
other. I'm still struggling with what you're saying, because couldn't the jury believe as much of Calabrese's testimony as identified Shiro as a member of the outfit, but not believe his testimony that Shiro actually was involved in the murder?
They could believe, yes, in short. However, absent his identification of Mr. Shiro involved in this particular incident, there is no other evidence that would support a finding that he was a member of the Chicago outfit. Thus, the only evidence that was offered to them, which could support a finding of guilty, in fact, was rejected by the jury in this case. We've also argued the matter of severance. I understand Your Honor has positions on whether or not the conduct of other individuals in the courtroom is solved by severance. I understand your position that it's not. However, Mr. Shiro moved for severance prior to trial based on the overwhelming weight of the evidence as to other defendants and not to him. I won't reiterate that, just simply to say that Mr. Shiro was further prejudiced by Mr. Lombardo's testimony that he was acquainted with him. And if there's no further questions, I'll reserve my time.
Okay, thank you very much, Mrs. Winslow. Mr. Scorza?
May it please the Court, Counsel. Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Thomas Scorza, and I represent Anthony Doyle in this appeal. I'm here to argue for reversal of Anthony Doyle's conviction under the RICO conspiracy count one, and also to argue for either dismissal of that count against him or entry of a judgment of not guilty on that count. I'm willing to face it that those are not statistically probable outcomes. But the family secrets case was a rare case in many ways. The most interesting way, its RICO conspiracy count is, I believe, in the whole 40-year history plus of RICO, absolutely unique. And unfortunately, what happened in this case, from my point of view, is that the government did not put as much care into the jury instructions as it did into the charging decisions that generated the unique RICO conspiracy count. What was unique about the count, the RICO conspiracy count in this case, is that it did four things in one count at the same time. First,
But just to be clear, Mr. Scorza, these are not arguments that were made at the district court level. So you are asking us to find plain error.
Correct.
And my problem with that is that it's been very unclear whether we're looking at two different ways of committing an offense or whether we're looking at two different offenses, in other words, means versus elements. And if it's unclear, then I would look to the rest of the record, and there's quite a bit of evidence that, in his own way, Mr. Doyle helped this organization along. He participated in it. He was a member of it. He knew what it was doing. He, you know, all of the things that were necessary. So I'm not sure, even if you're right, and that this should have been charged as two separate offenses, how can we find plain error on this record?
I don't agree that it's unclear, frankly. What measures the correctness or not correctness are primarily it's the words of the statute. That's the holding, for instance, in the Rodriguez case, which is the application of the general rule of the United States versus Wells. The question about a criminal statute is always the words of the statute. I read the words of the statute. I offered a reading of the words of the statute. The government not only didn't challenge that reading, but the government offered no other reading. It's not because I had a brilliant exposition. It's because there's no other reading of the statute. The fact of the matter is, the reading of the statute that I offered is what's behind the government's own wording of the statute. It's what's behind.
Now, you have some interesting arguments, but on the other hand, the government's relying on the United States against Pepe case and other cases, even the Williams case. I'm not aware of too many cases that have applied Richardson to this statute. And so, in a sense, even if you're right, why is the error plain?
The error is plain because once one focuses on the question, the statute makes it plain that the alternative grounds, the government called it, are set out different elements and not different means. It accounts for the fact that in every other case where the government prosecutes, including this case, by the way, where the government prosecutes the collection of unlawful debt, the government insists that the elements are different. That's what's behind the idea that you only need to agree to one collection of unlawful debt. The government has always insisted on that. The Justice Department, as I pointed out in the organized crime manual, says these can be charged in one count or two. The significance of that is it's really an admission that they're not mere means, as we say. The Blockburger test would point the exact same way. And the fact of the matter is the Supreme Court itself has made it clear that we judge these things by correct understandings of the statute at the time of appellate consideration.
Well, you do if it's all been preserved properly, but I think we would be the first court to hold what you're talking about.
I think and that is not surprising because of how rare the circumstance is.
Well, maybe not. I mean, I know there's the racketeering, there's the unlawful debt branch, but it still means that you're saying that by failing to go beyond what the lawyers did, discover the error by himself, and give a broader or more comprehensive unanimity instruction than he gave, that the district court committed reversible error. And if it's not that clear, then it fails that part of plain error. And if there was a lot of evidence anyway against Mr. Doyle, then the fairness, integrity, or public reputation of the trial wouldn't be affected by choosing to overlook it here.
I think Your Honor's position can't be squared with what the Supreme Court itself did in Johnson versus United States.
Well, we're not the Supreme Court, obviously.
So. But the Johnson gave a lesson to the appellate courts. In Johnson versus United States, there was a female defendant in that case. She was prosecuted for perjury in front of the grand jury. The trial judge took the issue of materiality away from the jury, decided himself in accord with Supreme Court and circuit precedent at the time. Just right after that trial, when she was convicted, The Supreme Court revisited the matter of materiality in the Galvin case, discovered that it was wrong previously in its own case, Sinclair, and a whole bunch of circuit courts were also wrong, and said, you know what? It is an error to take the materiality issue away from the jury. In the Johnson case, the government's position was, well, it couldn't have been a plain error because, after all, the trial judge was following the Supreme Court at the time. And the Supreme Court's answer was, no, you judge it by the correct law at the time of appellate consideration. If you ask yourself the interesting question, what could the trial judge have done in the Johnson case to avoid plain error? The answer is to do something other than the Supreme Court had recommended at the time, which shows, I think, that in the end, what's important is the statute and the words of the statute, as is always true in a criminal case.
What it shows to me is that there's a hierarchy in the judicial system, and the trial court in that case wasn't really free to disregard what the Court of Appeals had said, was compelled. Sometimes you can write something and say, not really sure about this, but you've got to wait until the next court in the chain fixes
something. That's correct, but what's significant to me about the history of that case is that the Supreme Court said in the end that the trial judge committed plain error. And
what is it exactly that you want? I don't know. You have a long list of what is the most serious error in the instructions in your view?
I think the one that I would regard as the key one would be the one that Judge Wood is talking about right now. The jury was not instructed that to find Anthony Doyle guilty.
I'm sorry. To
find Anthony Doyle guilty of the conspiracy charge, it would have to decide unanimously whether he had agreed to the conduct of the affairs of the enterprise through a pattern of racketeering activity on the one hand, or through collection of unlawful debt on the other. I say those are two different, that's charging two different criminal offenses, a conspiracy to commit two different offenses, and when you have a conspiracy to commit two different offenses, as Your Honor noted in the Griggs case, the proper jury instruction is the jury has to decide whether or not unanimously, whether the defendant agreed to A or B or both, but considering them each separately.
So it's like Richardson, basically. Your
exactly.
position is that
exactly.
there has to be unanimity at this next
exactly.
layer.
Exactly. And in the Justice Department manual that I've cited, there's an extensive discussion of Richardson and the worry. What does it mean for RICO? It has some ideas about that, but the one thing they do not do is what the government didn't do in this case, prepare for the statute. What does the statute tell us? And I say, and I still say, the government hasn't laid a glove on the argument, the statute makes it clear that these are not like the overt acts issue that Your Honor discussed in the Griggs case. These are not mere means. These are different elements. These are different offenses. If the government charged...
So there should have been two instructions? I'm just...
There should have been an additional instruction as to the unanimity requirement. What the instruction said was you can, the first element's instruction to the jury, which of course the jury was told they had to obey, was you first have to find that the defendant in question, Anthony Doyle, agreed to the conduct of the affairs of the enterprise through a pattern of racketeering activity or collection of unlawful debt.
So you think it should have been was what?
A follow-up instruction that said, in deciding that
would be all right, but
okay.
do you have to add something? Is that
an instruction. What was it? The omission.
That's fine, but you have. So what is it you think they should have been added?
The omitted instruction would be, in deciding that point, you have to be unanimous as to each of those alternative grounds separately.
That sounds very confusing to me.
Well, and doesn't it make a difference, too, that this is a conspiracy charge and not a substantive offense charge where unanimity shakes out a little differently?
No, I think because we're talking about it's the same fact pattern. If you have a Section 371 conspiracy to rob a bank and to defraud a bank, the instructions in that case, as Judge Posner pointed out in the Griggs case, in that type of case, dual objective conspiracy, the instructions say, the proper instructions, in deciding whether the defendant is guilty of the conspiracy, you have to decide separately, by unanimously, is he guilty of the bank robbery part and or the bank fraud part. Those would be separate instructions.
I don't see, actually, how how Doyle's lawyer can be faulted for not having proposed that second instruction. That is so confusing. The two together, they're gibberish.
It's no more confusing.
There must be some better way. A juror couldn't understand that combination of instructions.
I disagree, Judge.
I can't.
The alternative, the instruction about aiding and abetting, that instruction included the proper admonition.
Well, how's it done in Richardson? Is it separate instructions? You have to find unanimously this
as to each of the violations charged.
Yeah,
correct.
Each violation. As so, I mean, maybe there would have been a way of structuring it.
But not in two instructions. That's what I don't understand.
To my mind, there would have been nothing more on this matter, nothing more to add to the instruction than what is contained in the instruction that was given about aiding and abetting. It just points out, in deciding either one, you must be unanimous.
So you're afraid that six of the jurors thought he was racketeering and the other six thought it was unlawful debt.
Correct, especially in light of what the evidence was against him, which is extremely flimsy in this case, extremely flimsy.
The instruction is addressed to the jury as a unit.
Correct.
You must unanimously find X or Y. It doesn't really suggest that they're that half of them can vote for one and half for the other.
No, but it's fair to read the instructions, obviously, in the whole. And Judge Zagel gave an incorrect instruction on the overt acts of a conspiracy count later in the indictment count 8. He told the jurors in that
just
instruction.
Just talking about this first instruction, I think the jury would understand that they'd have to find unanimously A or unanimously B or unanimously both, that they weren't going to split it.
Well, on that, I just simply disagree, Your Honor. I think in the context of the instructions as a whole, that was an invitation to find either one. In fact, the arguments of the prosecutor made that very, very likely.
To the jury as a whole. The jury has to be unanimous. So once you say the jury has to be unanimous, all the other instructions are addressed to the jury. You have to, if the next instruction is you have to convict, you have to find X. That means, well, I said you had to be unanimous, so you have to find, all of you have to agree on X, or you all have to agree on Y. I think that's how a jury would ordinarily understand.
Well, I just
knows juries have to be unanimous, right? I mean, that's everyone knows that.
But this said or. It told them they had to be unanimous.
Well, yeah, you could you, the jury, as a unit, 12 of you, voting unanimously, you can find him guilty of this, you can find him guilty of that. There's no suggestion that some of you can find him guilty of this and others can find him guilty of that. That's fine, right? There's no hint of that in the instructions. So when you're talking about an invitation, I think that's very unrealistic.
Well, the government argued it because I think it was the implication of the instruction. The jury was told in another instruction that if unanimity was required within an instruction, they would be told so. They weren't told so. Just weren't. They weren't told, by the way, not only on this point, they weren't told that one of the acts in a RICO conspiracy charge had to be after...
In assessing the plainness of the error, I don't think you're being realistic about how jurors understand instructions.
Was the jury given a no unanimity instruction on the pattern aspect?
No, there was
the
no
case?
Further instruction on the pattern.
Okay.
The instructions as a whole, my argument in the this is the case that where seven dogs didn't bark, essentially, because the jury was not given instructions on several aspects of the pattern. This was one of them that has to do with the commission of a crime, of one of the agreements to commission of an offense after the RICO enactment date, whether the two offenses that you found were within 10 years, the last was within 10 years of a former one, and so on. And the Glesher issue, of course, which we haven't gotten to.
But I think Judge Sykes's question is important. If the jury is confused, you expect them to send a note. You know, it's a complicated case, long trial. And just adding instructions, that's just not realistic. You don't help a jury by adding instructions, right?
Well,
I'll
stand on the point that...
Along with the instructions.
The instructions in this case were probably on the printed version were something like 105 pages.
Well, of course, that's preposterous, right?
Right.
That is
correct.
Preposterous.
Correct.
No jury should be subjected to 105 pages.
Correct.
And you want it to be 106 pages.
Contrary, Judge. The instruction that I think was missing was the same one line that was contained in the aiding and abetting instruction.
Well, and each page just has a couple of sentences on it, right?
Right. It still takes a lot of pages of the transcript.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Scorza. Now we'll hear from the government. Mr. Fullerton?